Council meeting of November 16th, 1982.
Primary of that. Here's that we have a quorum. Call a meeting to order, please. Mr. Charney, please call the roll of the council.
Senator Ray. Senator Rohde.
Present.
Representative Baska.
Here.
Chairman Malone.
Here.
Representative Byrne.
Here.
Senator Bennett. Representative Brown.
Here.
Senator Dankworth. Senator Eliason. Speaker Hayes. Senator Kelly.
Here.
President Kurtula. Representative Miller.
Here.
Representative Phillips.
Here.
He's present.
We have a quorum. First item on the agenda is approval of the minutes of the last meeting of the council.
Mr. Chairman, I would move an unanimous consent that the minutes of the previous meeting of October 1, 1982 be approved.
Is there discussion on the motion? Hearing no discussion. Motion's adopted. In addition to the items that we have on the agenda under old business, we've had some requests for presentations to the council today. One from the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, one from Professor Konigsberg, and a request for an opportunity to appear. Actually, it was a request for an invitation. Perhaps an invitation would be a better description, to Mr. Milton Lipton. And I think there was at least one other item of business, two other items of business that were brought up to me by Representative Fuller. Jack, do you want to sit at the table?
I was just going to wait for you to talk to the board.
Okay. Are there other items of business that should be added to the agenda at this time? Members of the council or other legislators?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'd like to add to the agenda a discussion about the status of covering the legislature with Capital 83 this year, and discuss something of that. My understanding is that absolutely no coverage is anticipated at this time. I think that Capital 83 program is a benefit to the people throughout the state, and I think that we should reinstate it. And if we're going to do that, I think the council should take some action rather quickly.
Is there objection to adding that item to the agenda? Hearing no objection, incorporate that item on the agenda. Are there other items to be added to the agenda? Okay, if not, I guess we'll proceed down the agenda. The Fairbanks meeting, of which there was a discussion covered in the minutes of October 1, there was consideration given by the council to a proposal for a subscription to certain publications and reports, presentation given to council by Mr. Bradner. Mr. Bradner is present here today. What are the wishes of the council on this item? Representative Miller.
Mr. Chairman, I've had occasion to do the board report in the past, and I think they could indeed be very useful. I would move that we become a subscriber to these services. I'll ask unanimous consent.
We have a motion. Is there discussion on the motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I would see the value perhaps in the Alaska Economic Report and the Alaska Legislative Digest. I'm not so sure that the Alaska series is something that Legislative Council should commit to. It seems to me that there's a number of these types of reports that could probably come in and ask for the same type of consideration. I would have no objection to the Economic Report and the Digest. I'm a little concerned about the series.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
Chairman, I would support either proposal. I suppose there's a fair argument that the Alaska series may be something that individual committees, depending upon their subject matter, might want to subscribe to, and along with other similar matters. And as far as the economic report in the Alaska Legislative Digest, based upon who the subscribers are to this and the influence it seems to have, that although I will not be with you, I'll be reading it, and I don't think you really want to not know what others are believing about you because this influential report is saying things about you.
There's been some discussion on the motion. Are there amendments to the motion? Representative Miller.
We're in an awkward position here. There's only eight of us here, so if there is objection to part of the thing, I think it's the whole thing could go down. So in deference to being expressed by the Senator, I'll, if with your permission, withdraw that motion and instead move that we subscribe on an institutional basis to the two services.
Before that's done, I'd like just to make a comment.
Senator Rohde?
I don't know whether Senator Kelly expressed strong reservations or just raised a question. I think the Alaska series is important. It deals, certainly in the past, it's dealt with major resource questions that the legislature's dealt with. It's also dealt with the major sources of money that fund the programs that lower local taxes, provide all our state loans and everything else. They're absolutely critical, pivotal elements in the legislature's yearly agenda, and I think they're important for that reason. And I just wondered if my distinguished colleague was raising a question or had a strong objection, because they do cover the most pertinent points that that we've faced in the past and will be facing in the future.
Well,
Senator Kelly,
I think at this time I have a strong objection. That doesn't mean that I wouldn't change my mind in the future, but I just assume hold it to the two that I feel are necessary at this time, and then take a look at the series another day. Maybe I don't have enough experience to realize what it's doing.
Representative Miller?
Now, that being the case, Mr. Chairman, I will withdraw my earlier motion under the body of the said move that we subscribe to the Alaska Economic Report and to the Alaska Legislative Digest and Alaska Management Center.
We have a motion. Is there discussion on the new motion? Is there discussion on the motion? Representative Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, on the Alaska Legislative Digest, I believe we already have one. What's the name of that legislative report? Or are we dropping that in lieu of this? Or what's the status on,
Mr. Chair,
on that?
Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I think that question was asked at the last meeting, and my understanding is that they're mutually exclusive services. That is, and I understand that the publishers of the two respective services even urge their subscribers or clients to subscribe to the other in order to get the total picture. They really provide different kinds of information, and I suppose they might go into that detail again, but that was discussed extensively at the last meeting, I thought.
For further discussion? The unanimous consent has been asked. Is there objection to the motion? There's no objection. The motion is adopted. The other item that we had on the agenda for the Fairbanks meeting was a contract proposal from Mr. Mr. Rhett Spear and Associates. I don't know if anyone is here to represent that company. I did talk to Mr. Spear on the telephone prior to the last meeting, who told me he thought that the proposal would have to be revised based on the length of time that was available for the preparation of a report before the legislative session, before the legislature could use the information during the session. I don't know if anyone's here to represent the firm today. Apparently not.
Chairman?
Representative Miller.
I'll move this be a decision on this be deferred until the next meeting.
We have a motion to defer consideration of the
ask unanimous consent.
Rhett Spear proposal to the next meeting. Unanimous consent has been asked. Is there objection? Hearing no objection, the motion is adopted. I will attempt to get the revised proposal from Mr. Spear for the next meeting. See if we can get a member of the firm to explain it as well. Brings us down to other business. There is one person that has made a request through me to talk to the council. Mr. Konigsberg was here today. If the members of the council have no objection, maybe we could hear from Mr. Konigsberg. Is there objection?
This subject matter is
has to do with the some of the review processes instituted by the legislature. Mr. Konigsberg.
I'm here to present the what I regard as a serious complaint of both the failure and the refusal of the ombudsman to do its job as required under Alaska statutes. And I'm here to ask the council if, after due consideration, they would see to it that the ombudsman does its job. My own feeling is that an agency of this kind, which is charged with assisting citizens so that as to make it unnecessary for them to go to court. If this is not done, then I don't see any point to funding the institution. Specifically, it involves my allegations of discriminatory, unfair, and inequitable treatment on the University of Alaska with respect to a faculty appointment. I'm not here to make the case on that point. But I'm here to say that the ombudsman that had accepted my complaint as legitimate in April of 1981 has at best completed approximately one-third of its investigation, but has chosen to close out the file and to ignore all the evidence that has been submitted by me and others, which would, for a funny fair-minded person, argue that the investigation is, as I say, far from complete. I can demonstrate, for example, and again, not by way of making the case, I can demonstrate that the university has violated at least its own regulations at least 21 times, that the proceedings of the search committee and its selection process in no sense have been fair and equitable, and yet this has been ignored by the ombudsman. The principal response of the ombudsman to my request that he continue the investigation to its proper conclusion is that since I presumably am seeking as my principal motive personal relief, and since the ombudsman, of course, does not have the power to provide personal relief, therefore the ombudsman is not obligated to complete any investigation. It's kind of ludicrous in a sense, because the statutes themselves point out that the ombudsman can refuse to even initiate an investigation or conduct one if there isn't a personal involvement in the process by the person who complains of it. So it seems to me that this argument that my interest in seeking personal relief, which is not my entire purpose, but certainly one of my purposes, is an evasion. and makes a mockery of the duties and responsibilities of the ombudsman. As to why the ombudsman has chosen this course, you know, I can only speculate. There are four possibilities that have occurred to me. One is the ombudsman's personal friendship with the person who was selected for the particular faculty position in question. Another is that, possibility, he decides he doesn't like me. Another possibility is that he would prefer I take it to court. And it's the last possibility that is most upsetting to me, because anybody who's had any experience with a government agency in recent years finds that the most frustrating aspect is the interminable delay. I've been told again and again by persons who've had such experiences that I will find. And I was told this numerous times when I first began my own investigation into the situation, that I'd better learn patience and to hang on, because the object in so many cases is to get you so disgusted with the proceedings that you give up and they'll take it to court. I had assumed that the creation of agencies like the ombudsman, and certainly historically it's supposed to be the case, is so as to enable citizens to avoid taking such matters to court, crowding the court dockets and so on. I have now had this experience with both the ombudsman and the Human Rights Commission. The delay. And I'm asking that the council, as I say, after due consideration and looking into the matter, require the ombudsman to do the job for which it is presumably created. Well, there's considerably more to be said, but I just don't know how much you want to get into it.
Questions or comments from members of council? Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, you said that your complaint was offered in April of 1981. Wasn't that just before there was a change in the office of the ombudsman?
Yes.
Okay. I believe that the new ombudsman may have taken office in June or July, something like that.
Yes, July.
And then I happened to sit on the subcommittee on the budget this last year with regard to the budget of the ombudsman. And at least the testimony I heard was that following the election of a new ombudsman, and the candidate was the incumbent, that there were many people who left the office of the ombudsman, and there was a serious case management problem immediately following that, and a requirement that there be many new people brought in because of those resignations.
Yes.
Do you have any indication that it may be that management problem that is part of your problem? You did not list it as one of your possible explanation.
That is a partial explanation of why the ultimate report by the ombudsman took as long as it did. It is irrelevant to the point that the ombudsman has decided, this is many months ago, that the work that had been done, however incomplete, was adequate to close the file. In other words, the ombudsman has made a decision that the file is closed and will stay closed. Not because he wasn't able to manage the investigation properly, but because, as I pointed out earlier, he has decided that he is not going to pursue it any further.
Well, you understand, of course, apparently you've read the statute probably more recently than we have, although I think Mr. Miller was present at the creation of the ombudsman, was part of the reason we have one right now. You understand that, of course, the ombudsman power is basically persuasive and informational with regard to any governmental entity. And at least during the time we were writing the bill, and I think Mr. Phillips and Mr. Miller were around, maybe Mr. Phillips was on staff, Mr. Miller was involved, Mr. Malone, who saw it at the Finance Committee, a couple of others here. My memory is that there was a problem of dealing with the powers of the ombudsman with regard to the University of Alaska, because we have this constitutional problem we've always had, a little line we draw, they sued us, we sued them, we agreed not to have that side of the case decided because it's probably an inherent line under the Constitution anyway. But what exactly do you think statutorily the ombudsman would have had the authority to do that he did not do had he agreed more with you?
I'm saying to you that the ombudsman has refused to call a spade, for example. And I'm not in a position to assess the motives or even reasoning, because it reason is still. The ombudsman has not exercised any of his powers, such as subpoena powers, to subpoena documents which are relevant to this matter. The ombudsman has simply taken the word of personnel interviewed as to what has or hasn't taken place. The ombudsman has simply ignored, which is to say, in no way taken notice of, no mention of, relevant point after relevant point after relevant point. For example, in my own efforts, I have written an analysis of 47 pages. Of this 47 pages, the ombudsman has chosen to take notice of exactly three lines on page 28, period. And what I'm saying to you is, but at the moment you have to take my word for it, of course, is that these are all documentable, demonstrable violations and inequities, not speculations. They are not even referred to in the ombudsman's report. The problem of the ombudsman's exercising certain powers vis-a-vis the university, which may or may not be a real one, is irrelevant to the point, although, you know, I understand why you brought it up. It's not that there was a question of whether could or couldn't be done by the ombudsman. The point I'm making to you is the ombudsman didn't concern himself enough to try.
Representative Brown, may I interrupt you long enough to give Senator Rody the floor for a moment? He raised his hand at the same time.
I wish to make a motion at this time, and my motion would be that the chairman frame the question that Professor Konigsberg has proposed to the council, request the ombudsman to respond in detail to the concern expressed by Professor Konigsberg, and that this matter be put before the council at the next meeting. I think it's imperative that, because we did create the ombudsman, we the legislature, it's imperative that we look into allegations of actions that haven't been taken, and certainly the articles we have. So I would make that motion now, Mr. Chairman.
There's a motion by Senator Rody. Discussion on the motion with Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I support the motion because it relates to the next question I was about to ask Professor Konigsberg. Did you inform the ombudsman that you were going to bring this matter before the council at this meeting?
No, because I don't remember whether I said that specifically, but in my last conversation with the ombudsman on a telephone matter, you know, I told him I would pursue it further. What I have done since then is Representative Phillips, as one that I contacted because he was on the Ombudsman Selection Committee, and he was very busy at the time legislatively, and he wasn't able to pursue it in detail. I also contacted Senator Sturgeluski, who subsequently, some weeks or months later, she and I got together. I gave her the details. She reviewed them all. With the ombudsman, they decided that there would be, they would either would or would attempt to initiate an investigation of the University of Glasgow's hiring practices because there had been a long history of such problems.
Well, the reason I ask the question, of course, is that, for instance, if the University of Alaska were to bring up a matter involving your ability to do your job in a public meeting without inviting you to attend, you would probably cry foul. So I know nothing about the merits of the case. You may well have a very excellent case. I'm just saying it would have been a bit more fair to inform the ombudsman that the matter was going to be brought up here with members of the press listening and all of that. Well, so on that basis, I do support the motion.
Yeah, Representative Brown, and that matter, without, you know, without having any indication of how the council might want to handle this. I'm not sure there was any other way to proceed here.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow or another, this question would have to come in front of the council first.
Oh, I agree with that. It's just it would seem that he would have been informed.
And having a full-scale hearing at the council meeting cold, I think it would be important to get the information if the council wants to pursue it, and that's the reason for appearance, Mr. Clinton.
Mr. Chairman, I intend no criticism of the professor, and I know nothing at all about his case, and I have heard relatively little about the functioning of the ombudsman since the new ombudsman came in, except with regard to the matters that came up in the committee. I was just hoping that this can be handled in a way so that everybody's able to find out what really is going on. So I support the motion of asking unanimous consent.
Chairman.
Comments on the motion or on the question, Representative Byrne?
Yeah, well, I just have one question. When's the next council meeting? That's what the,
be up to the council.
You don't have a schedule yet. Because that timing of that might be important, but it could be for a short time.
Isn't there a traditional one just before session or something?
I wonder if December's.
Well, it's going to be at least a month in theory, so that probably would be.
Probably it will. Representative Phillips?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have the motion restated for today.
As the maker of the motion, in response to Mr. Phillips' question, the motion was that the chairman of the council draft a letter to the ombudsman, essentially reiterating Professor Konigsberg's concerns, and that the chairman ask the ombudsman to respond in writing and in detail to the council on the questions raised by Professor Konigsberg.
Do you also have to become an agenda item in the next meeting?
Yes.
If the motion is adopted, the letter and the response would, of course, be made available to all members of the council. Without the without action by the council, it's not clear to me that the response, what to do with the response, so I think it should be taken up at the next council meeting. To put that in plain English, Mr. Konigsberg, is that I'm not sure that you should get a copy of it before it comes up at the next meeting without seeing what the response is. I don't know. Perhaps this is an issue on which the council might want to hold an executive session. Is there discussion on the motion? Ready for the question?
Question.
Is there objection to the motion?
Unanimous consent was asked.
Unanimous consent was asked. Is there objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, motion is adopted. Thank you. We're temporarily shy of a quorum, but I think we can proceed with discussion at least of other business. Between the last meeting and this one, I was approached by people who were concerned with the failure of the effort through the failure of funding on the task force on fire prevention control established by the legislature. Funding for the completion of the work was not provided for one reason or another in the budget this year. People that have been carrying on that work want to know if they could get an early start in its completion. I have people here today from the Task Force on Fire Prevention Control, the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. Last week, I think it was Monday, he sent a letter to members of the council and specifically the President of the Senate and Speaker of the House, bringing this matter to their attention and pointing out if the council were to take action on it, that it would probably require the allocation of funds from the House and Senate leadership budgets. Now, those presiding officers are not here today, but there are people from the Chiefs Association. What is the pleasure of the council? I personally would prefer to hear from the people from the Fire Chiefs Association before proceeding. Representative Phillips.
Chairman, I do also feel that we should have a presentation here. I've been briefed on it yesterday, but I think some of the members haven't, so
I
think we'd be a good idea.
I support the chair.
Representative Vasco.
Mr. Chairman, what are we going to do if, in fact, we need to make a decision today, or do we need to make a decision today? Some of the presiding officers who have an interest in this are not here on this. And if we hear them out today, we may have to hear them again.
I think there's several ways of handling it. The council could indicate their concurrence subject to the approval of the presiding officers, for example. There's several different ways it could be done, I think, if the council wanted to pursue it. But if there's no objection, maybe we could have a brief presentation from the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. I don't know who the spokesman is here today. Mr. Schoenberg?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I'm Bob Schoenberg. I'm vice president of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. I'm also their representative on the Task Force of Fire Prevention and Control. What I would like to review is just a very brief history of the Task Force of Fire Prevention and Control, what our request is, and where we're at. The problems which resulted in the creation of the Task Force of Fire Prevention and Control have not been resolved. Fortunately, the concern and support of Alaskans to continue to fight our fire problems have not diminished, but have grown. The task force was formulated to systematically research Alaska's fire problems and then with input from all possible sources to develop workable solutions. This has never been tried before in Alaska, the state with the highest loss of life and property due to fires. Unfortunately, this small but important project was prematurely terminated in June of this year. With delays at the start, the actual unimpeded work time for the task force was about 1 year and 2 months instead of the projected 3 years. Obviously, the work was left unfinished. The first step toward the well-planned effort to solve Alaska's fire problem was halted in mid-strike. It is essential that we lose as little time as possible in resuming our pace. The Alaska Fire Chiefs and the Alaska Firefighters Association addressed the premature report of the task force published in June of this year during their annual convention in Ketchikan in October. The review of the report was encouraging. The general feeling was that the report was of good quality, but unacceptably unfinished. Some of the areas needing more work were state reorganization of fire-related programs, 2, master planning, 3, YLM fire problems, 4, arson, 5, equipment grants, and 6, insurance credit for fire surveys. Both associations resolved at their annual meetings to seek funding of the task force at the earliest possible moment. The Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, with support of the task force members and the Alaska Firefighters Association, has volunteered to seek a direct grant and administer the funds for the task force. We believe that this will provide the best environment for the quickest resumption of the project. The Fire Chiefs Association is completely capable of administering the funds and have proposed a directorate of 3 highly qualified and experienced administrators to manage the program. Also, the previous director of the task force, who was with the program since its inception, is presently currently available and will be for the near future. He has indicated that he would again accept the position. We feel that it is very important that we bring his experience and specific knowledge back into the project. Another point, with the passage of the constitutional amendment limiting appropriations, we understand that this could very well have adverse effects on supplemental appropriations, and if so, it may be very difficult to fund the task force through supplemental appropriations during the next session. Considering the urgency, we feel that this council may be our only hope for the continuation of the task force project. We urge that you consider our request and act on it, and we'd be here to answer any questions that you may have.
One question I have, and I guess it would be to Mr. Charney or to our legal counsel. if the council were to issue a contract for the completion of this work to a group such as the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association in the approximate amount that's being requested, which is on the order of $100,000, my memory serves me correctly, some sort of special finding is required by the committee as to the particular group being the most suitable, or in fact the only group that can carry on the work. Is that legally correct?
Either rules or possible 154.
It's in the law.
In effect, it's a sole source contract. Mm-hmm. You are correct, of course.
What sort of finding is required there, Mr. Barrier?
You would have to find that because of unique qualifications or because of particular prior work that has been done by this group, that it would be advantageous to the state to continue. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but those are the essential two factual requisites, that there's either unique knowledge or prior experience in the field that would make this group uniquely qualified.
You have to have a copy of the statutes. Representative Miller.
I agree with Mr. Baird. That statute. However, if we did make a recommendation to the presiding officers, ask and recommend it, that they fund it. I suppose if Mr. Barry or somebody else took a later look at the law, they could determine that sole source is not the only avenue, and it could be made, put out on a so-called competitive bid, under which circumstances I have no doubt in my mind that really been successful would be the firefighters. But I don't think we're stuck necessarily with only a sole source. It's just that some time would take place. Instead of getting to work on it right away, they'd probably have to wait maybe 60 or 90 days or something like that, while the non-salt sole source procedures of the statutes were accomplished. So I don't think we have to worry at this meeting whether it's sole source or not. If we can do it sole source and it's perfectly above board and proper, and we can and should, but if it's not, it just simply means that we have to spend a little bit more time in the red tape department, and then we could still do it, and the same monies would be available. I'm sure everything red tape calls for would be done before this legislature adjourns, so they could be at it in 2 or 3 months, even on the worst case situation. So therefore, I don't think we have to worry about the statute all that much.
Well, I think we definitely have to take the statute into account.
Oh yeah, but I mean, we can. The statute, I think, will allow us to do it either way. Yeah, we've got to do it by the statute.
Mr. Chairman,
156. I was wrong. I was up by one number.
Representative Brown.
Chairman, I don't want to ask any embarrassing questions, but who was supposed to be carrying your water and didn't?
Pardon?
Who was supposed to be carrying your water and didn't?
In the lake process.
I think there was a failure and misunderstanding that occurred last year. We were budgeted through Committee of Regional Affairs, and apparently at one critical point during the session, during the finance committee, we did not have anybody from the town that would make a presentation for us. We dropped the ball at the end.
So a committee was presented with no backup on a line item or something like that?
I think there may have been questions that wanted to be asked, and there was nobody there to answer.
If so, you have to tell the driver.
And also deal with the number of task force and our community regional affairs. They had their budget problems. A program that was going to terminate on June 30th, 1983, and I think we were kind of sacrificed and we were supposed to think that they wanted to.
So there's no way you can learn this before the next meeting.
we had a dedicated license
right, okay.
I think part of your birch was involved with the House Commerce Committee during the time I chaired it.
I'm sure it was. There's one point, the task force itself is still viable. The members of the task force, the only thing that we do not have is funding for the task force to carry out its work, but we still have the 9 task force members, and they all are very interested in completing this project. We all felt the same way that we were forced to complete a project that was unfinished, and we know that we can do a much better job, and it's a very important area.
Well, I guess the Mr. Barrier must be referring, are you, if I may continue, Mr. Chairman.
Please go ahead, Mr. Brown.
To what is page 8 of the session law, D1?
No.
Or that's on agencies. That's on agencies.
Page 3, sections C and D.
That's right. The two bills were merged. 3. Which is nearly the same language.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to consider both C and D.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Mr. Chairman, I forgot there were two bills, and I guess we're merging the one in the Senate. One person.
Representative Miller.
Put the question legally before us. I'll move that we recommend to the state officers that funds in the amount of $100,000 exact amount.
$103,000.
$103,000
for fiscal year 82.
Be allocated for the purpose of completing the study. With that.
Well, it's actually continuation of the study.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's what I thought I said. It's continuation of the study. About $103,000. The assumption would be that if the presiding officers concur in that recommendation, they would forward to Mr. Charney's office to process the thing, either right. On the sole source basis or if deemed necessary.
To go over the rules a little bit, what it would require is if the council does not have itself the funds to enter into a contract right now, but if the funds were available, there would also have to be two things. There would have to be an exemption and a written justification approved, an exemption approved by a majority vote of the committee. There'd have to be a contract in front of the committee to approve, so that's two things there, plus a written justification signed by the person responsible for awarding the contract that details the reasons for the exemption. So those documents would have to be prepared for action, I presume, by the council before a contract could take effect, and I don't believe it could take effect through simple administrative action. Mm-hmm. Representative Brown.
Chairman, I'd like to inquire, Mr. Barrier, is it possible, council, that the written materials included with the proposal for funding from the council that includes a budget could, along with the minutes of this meeting, constitute the contract that is referred to in the section, if we were also then to make by motion a specific finding that it appears that only one group can clearly perform the required services because of their prior work, and that we therefore recommend to the presiding officers that the funding be made available if they concur with that finding. I suppose that would make them persons in authority under Section D, or would we be stretching it too far?
I would think that you'd be stretching it too far.
Well,
I haven't seen it before. I don't think that
before. Senator Kelly.
be sneaky lawyers to us.
Mr. Chairman, what's the possibility that, let's assume for a second that we're looking at a meeting, say, in early December down in Juneau of the council, our next meeting. What's the chances of having legal and ledge affairs at Burt Turney get together and come up with the necessary legalities for us to okay at that time? And between now and then, also take a look at the budget to see if there's any way that $100,000 figure could be cut back. And we would fund for fiscal year 83, I guess, until the end of June. Mm-hmm. And any further funding they'd have to get from the legislature as a whole in the next budget, with the understanding that council would not be responsible for funding it if the legislature chooses not to do so next session.
It'd just be through the end of the fiscal year in that case. I think looking at the specifics in the statute, that the document would have to be complete. That is, a document of the contract,
yes,
and the written justification. Well,
yeah, there's
the document. The document of the contract would have to be complete. At least the written justification, I guess, just has to be signed.
Chairman, Mr. Berry has pointed out to me that 040 on page 4 has a description of what has to be in the contract. So clearly, my suggestion, while clever, was clearly wrong.
But the it might be possible. I think it probably would, in the period of time outlined by Senator Kelly, it would be possible to get the answers to the questions on funding, and also, depending on those answers, get the necessary documents prepared for the consideration of the council at the next meeting. Because of the statute, I don't think we can go any further than that today. I mean, that's what it looks like to me. Senator Kelly.
I'd also like Mert Cherney to talk with those folks and find out if that budget can be cut at all. I think if they can bring it in.
Representative Miller.
I'll withdraw my motion.
Well, let's see. My motion would be then, because of the fact that we don't have the legal documentation in front of us that's necessitated by the new statute, that Legislative Affairs Agency prepare the necessary documents to present to the Legislative Council at its next meeting for action.
Working with the proponent.
Okay. Working with the proponent.
To prepare all materials necessary to comply with the statute.
And at the same time, to attempt to reduce the amount of money that's going to be absolutely necessary to carry it through the end of this fiscal year.
Fiscal year 83.
One thing that's left out of your motion, Senator Kelly, would be any recommendation at all to the presiding officers on what the council thinks about the proposal in general.
Well, then I would add to the motion that the council feels that it would request that the presiding officers make funding available.
Is there a discussion on the motion?
If the paperwork is acceptable at the next council meeting.
So it's really to abide the result of the next council meeting.
It's like a tentative approval on paperwork.
We're preparing it as though we'd approved it to see what it looks like.
Yes.
It's not approval. It's the first steps in that process. Okay, is there discussion on the motion?
Ask unanimous consent.
Unanimous consent has been asked before taking action on the motion. I want to thank the fire chiefs for their presentation, and also explain that although the task force is in existence, a contract for the operation of the study and report to the Fire Chiefs Association does require compliance with our new legislative contracting procedures, which is something that has just gone into effect. Representative Phillips?
Mr. Chairman, since requiring the Fire Chiefs Association to, you know, present all documentation before our next meeting, I hope they know who Mr. Barrier is and Mr. Charney, and I want to make sure of that. So that's Mr. Barrier. This is Mr. Charney. Get their card.
Is there further discussion on the motion? Unanimous consent has been asked. Is there objection? Hearing no objection, the motion is adopted.
Thank you very much.
We had two items that were brought up to me shortly before the meeting. I guess you could describe them as legislative housekeeping measures. It might be a good idea to take those up now. One was a request from Representative Fuller for the early hiring of Irene Cash and Representative Fuller.
That is correct, Chairman. I of course, came here in place of the Speaker of the House because he's on his way back from out of state. And he asked me to appear before you and request that you would approve Irene Cashin for coming on board as Chief Clerk of the House 2 weeks prior to the start of the legislative session, according to the statutes of this government.
We have the request. Senator Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, I would assume the Senate would make the same request concerning Peggy Mulligan. So I'd like to amend the motion to that effect. Have a notebook.
Well, we don't have a motion yet, actually, that amending the request. Representative Brown.
Chairman, I guess I will move that the two apparent designees already named be authorized to start work 2 weeks before the session serve at the pleasure of the present presiding officers of the two houses until such time as the two houses of the 13th legislature have organized.
Is there discussion on the motion?
Ask unanimous consent, Mr. Chairman.
Is there objection? Hearing no objection, the motion is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I did not want to be presumptuous and speak for the good old boys, so I appreciate Senator Kelly's help.
I'm a little presumptuous myself.
I'm even more presumptuous.
Mr. Irene, maybe you speak for the good old boys and the bad old boys.
Yeah.
There was another item of legislative housekeeping that was mentioned to me before this meeting started today, having to do with the allocation of legislative space. The council, under the statutes, is in charge of legislative space during the interim, and suggestion was made that the space that's currently occupied by the House in the current legislative space and by the Senate remain allocated to the House and Senate until both houses organize and the rules chairman meet to discuss, have a chance to meet to order the space assignments. And I think that would probably help to clarify questions of where a person should hang their hat at the beginning of the legislative session if organization has not already taken place, and would appreciate a motion from the council along those lines if people think it's a good idea. If they don't, well, it's fine with me too. But
It's the only way to proceed, Mr. Chairman. I would move, Mr. Chairman, that the present allocations of space between the House and the Senate be kept in full force and effect until new organizations in either body take control
in both bodies.
In both bodies,
not either body.
And ask unanimous.
We remember what happened two years ago.
We have a motion on the motion, Senator Kelly.
Chairman, I would amend that motion to the effect that any deviations or changes of office space between now and then would be would necessitate the okay from the Legislative Council Chairman. There might be some situations where a legislator might move out of his office early, not go all the way until December 17th. Somebody who's not returning, somebody else would want to move in there on a temporary basis. There should be a little slack, but in general, you know, we should keep, everybody should stay right where they are until everything's organized.
On that subject, I don't have the motion in front. I don't have the minutes in front of me. I believe that distinguished responsibility was visited on myself and Senator Ray by an earlier motion through the council.
I think that's the case. Meeting in Eagle River.
I said chairman of it.
Requires. Yeah, I noticed that. But at present, the current motion requires both a Senate, both the chairman and vice chairman. And as you know, we never agree. So.
Questions? We're asking you.
Okay.
First, I would move that Senator Kelly's amendment be considered part of my motion.
Now, which amendment?
Well, that's the one that any changes in space between now and the beginning of now an organization would have to be approved by both the Chairman,
and Vice Chairman. And I would ask unanimous consent on the motion. The motion as amended.
Okay, is there a discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion? Hearing no objection, the motion is adopted. One other item of business that was requested to be placed on the agenda was by Senator Kelly, and that's a discussion of the possible television coverage during the 1983 legislative session. Senator Kelly.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a real chatterbox today, but it's come to my attention that right now that there is no funding and no plans are going forth for the televising of the 1983 legislative session. I'm one that believes that it's been invaluable throughout the state. The capital, when did it start? Like 78, maybe? 77?
Yeah, 77.
77. I think it's invaluable. And I think the further you get away from Juneau, the more valuable it is to the residents of the state. And I'll be the first to say I didn't particularly care for the format last session where they went to the news briefs instead of the half-hour program. I prefer the half-hour program. But I think that the council should hopefully take a position that we would like to see the Capital 83 reestablished, and that a plan be drawn up by Legislative Affairs Agency, or a scenario drawn up, or some alternatives drawn up, that would allow that to go into place the first day of session this year if the funding becomes available. And if we're looking at an early December meeting, hopefully we would have the time between then and August to arrange something. And I don't know what the details are. I know it's complex. I know you got the bidding process, everything else, but I think it's important to the state that program be continued.
January.
Time.
The issue has been raised by Senator Kelly. What is the pleasure of the council in pursuing the question of television coverage for the 83 legislative session? Maybe Mr. Charney or someone else would like to comment on the practicality or the feasibility of doing something at this stage of the game, or this late in the year. Would you?
Mr. Chairman, members of the council, I think there are people out there in the wings that are just waiting for something to happen. Contractors that are waiting out there that will eagerly respond to any kind of proposal that we can put out. We could get a proposal out and have it ready for next time the council wishes to meet. And
probably would satisfy the, bid requirements if I could work with some, I could work with Mr. Engen, who issued proposals in the past, and if I could work with the chairman and the vice chairman of the council during the interim, I probably could advertise, proceed to advertise and have those bids in by the time the next council meets, and could have, and the council then could approve the contract at that meeting and provide the funds, I think, from the session budget. Mm-hmm. Further discussion, Representative Byrne?
I like the program, and I like Steve's opinion. Particularly this year, when we're sitting on the sidelines, I'd like to see my my colleagues in action down here. I'd like to be able to follow along on a daily basis and see what's going on. And I think it's really helpful. So I support the promotion.
Tune in the Homestead Bill. Representative Miller,
what Homestead Bill?
You've been doing some of the Homestead.
Representative Vasquez.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I was going to make a motion. The motion would be, in effect, what is being suggested, or what is being suggested by Mark Carney in terms of looking for the possibility of working with former contractors on the program. Speaking in favor, I would like also to speak in favor of reinstituting a daily coverage of the legislature, because I think the general public gets a better view of the day-to-day function and have, and at least have some availability to that through the media, especially true in rural Alaska, where most of the television is through the satellite demonstration project in Nebraska.
Some good discussion on this question, but we've had, I don't think you had a formal motion. Was that a formal motion?
The motion, Mr. Speaker, Chairman, will be that the staff prepare a presentation at our next council meeting for a daily program covering the state legislation.
Talking about
first session of the session.
Discussion on the motion.
Ask unanimous consent.
Okay, I have a question on the motion myself. From the expressions made here by members of the council, I get the impression, I suppose Mr. Charney does as well, that a program having daily coverage of activities in the legislature is what people would rather see on the tube than a weekly news wrap-up of the specials. It should be approached from that direction. Is there further discussion on the motion? Unanimous consent has been asked. Is there objection? Hearing no objection, I'd like to be added as a co-sponsor on the motion. No. Hearing no objection, the motion is adopted.
I think you were laughing with him still.
What did you say?
I don't know.
We do have present today Mr. Milton Lipton, whom I invited to come and address the council. I don't know what people's schedules are, whether they want to take a break before proceeding or whether you just want to proceed. Okay, excuse me just a minute. Mr. Charney also noted to me earlier that he had some things he'd like to bring up, Mr. Charney.
Mr. Chairman, members of the council, in case we lose a quorum during the break, I would like to make a statement for the record. There was an editorial in the Ketchikan Daily News last Saturday night that made some allegations against me. And I want to deny those publicly. I talked to Lou Williams, publisher of the paper, last night when I became aware of the article. And apparently it was a misinterpretation of a young girl to her mother, what she misinterpreted I was doing, was I was actively involved in the campaign during this past election. And I denied to Mr. Williams, and I denied publicly today that I took such an active part
wife was very active in the Pritchard campaign. I think it was well publicized. And I accompanied her, but I did not distribute any literature myself. I did not say any words. But I did want to make publicly state that for the record, so Tilden and Bud, in case other papers picked up that such a newspaper and start repeating that publication, repeating what was said.
We're getting allegations from little girls here without knowing.
No, I think she just misinterpreted what he said. Are there any questions by members of the council, Mr. Charney, on the subject? It probably would be fair if people do have those, they may have them now or later, but if they have any, to bring them to Ms. Charney's attention. And I appreciate your comments, Mr. Charney. Thank you. Representative Miller.
Before we take a break, probably in the middle of the presentation, I'm going to have to leave, so if anybody has a motion to require for
Senator Kelly.
To return on our next meeting date.
Yeah.
And may I suggest the governor's inaugural will be in Juneau on December 6th, is it?
Yeah.
That's just the swearing
that's the first.
I think that's
right, that's not the swearing in. The formal inaugural stuff will be the third Monday of November, I'm sure. Or the second Monday. November,
yeah.
August, January, I don't know what year it is.
The ceremony.
Oh, you saved my life. I've been passing notes over here about other times that were suggested. I will. Afternoon, I would hope, Mr. Chairman.
You want the list of anchors?
Okay, we have a motion for the. We have a motion to set the date for the next meeting for December 8th in Juneau. I presume that's an afternoon meeting.
That's a Wednesday.
Discussion on the motion.
Strongly support the motion.
We're talking about employer.
Me too.
Well, you may not have a board.
Is there discussion on the motion? Hearing no objection. Motion is adopted. Do the members wish to have a recess before continuing this business?
Mr. Chairman, could we take the time on that? Assuming about 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
There's a plane land.
What's the plane around?
Leave some discretion to the chair.
Oh, all right. Okay. I'll put 2.
And if you don't have the power,
in Randy, if you don't
let's
hear from
five
him,
minute break.
Take
power
over to
okay. Unless there's objection, we'll have a 5 minute recess. No objection.
Try 1:30 instead of 1 o'clock.
You Tony, you saved my life. I've been sending these complicated notes to Malone about that problem. I've got a concert to play in Fairbanks on the 5th, a concert to play in Anchorage on the 7th. My Christmas party is on the 18th, and I got to be in Fairbanks for that.
Okay, so you're in between now and December 8th, you solicit proposals. The council will attempt to pick the proposal on the 8th and then proceed with covering all that stuff.
Okay.
It's earlier. It would have been tomorrow.
It would be disaster probably in the second session.
Sure enough, we have representatives left, but no senators. So what else is new? Senators?
I think there may be some senators around, but we'd like to continue the meeting. At present time, we don't have a quorum, but I did invite Mr. Milton Lipton, who has been a consultant to the legislature on oil and gas matters for quite a number of years, although currently not under contract with the legislature, to come to the council meeting this afternoon. And I'm very glad that he sat through our meeting, our business portion of the meeting, and would like to thank him for coming. And Milt, could you come up to the table, please?
Thank you. Bill Knox, I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you. It was some weeks ago that I felt a terrible urge to tear myself away from my office and from New York City, and I wavered briefly between going down to the Caribbean and coming up to visit friends in Alaska. It's been 8 months since I've been here. That's been really the longest break in 13, 14 years now. So I came to visit friends in Alaska, and I'm pleased to know that I've got friends in the Legislative Council. Thank you for the invitation. I thought I would take just a few minutes, I don't want to tie you up for a long time, to discuss what's happening outside in terms of oil development and oil prices, and also the gas outlet. The last time I was here 8 months ago was for that very troubled session of the House Finance Committee, when the legislature was terribly worried about what was going to happen to revenues, to the budget. And I sat through a distressing 2 days in which almost everybody predicted a collapse of oil prices down to maybe $20 a barrel, with a 40% probability it might be down to $14 or $15 a barrel. And at least I had the pleasure of providing whatever assurances I could that the world oil prices were not going to collapse and that they were going to hang around in the range of $32 a barrel. And of course we've had since then a lot of downward pressure on oil prices, but weakness of oil prices is not the same thing as a collapse of oil prices, and OPEC has managed to do what was necessary but which most people thought couldn't be done. You know, OPEC had always been accused of being a cartel for years and years and years, and of course they weren't. But by March, they had to begin behaving like a cartel or things were really going to fall out, and so they did. Now, they can never be a cartel because there are too many conflicts within OPEC for them really to function like a proper cartel. Conflicts. I mean, two of them are at war with each other. But, you know, you can behave like a cartel without being like one, which means that everybody has to understand you can go just so far and no further. And, of course, they've been doing that. So this cartel was frayed around the edges all through 1982, but it didn't fall apart. It didn't unravel. And that essentially is the picture as of today. I was interested in this morning's paper to read a quote from the head of your petroleum division referring to Saudi Arabia's questionable resolve to maintain its OPEC benchmark price of $34. That was really very well put. Questionable resolve. You know, Saudi Arabia has been going through a cycle. In 1981, they overproduced like mad with the idea of pulling prices down, and now they're underproducing like mad with the idea of holding prices up. And here's Saudi Arabia having to juggle its oil policy in order to achieve its major purpose, which is let's not have Saudi Arabia and the dynasty torn apart by all of the conflicts around it. So they're really doing a juggling act. You know the story about the juggler who was really not very good. He was doing the music halls and so on, and he always followed the dog act and preceded the soprano, and he would keep going to his agent and asking his agent, listen, can't you get me more work? And the agent says, well, I'm trying. He says, well, I'll see you tomorrow. I'll call you tomorrow. And he says, don't call us, we'll call you. And one night, tossing and turning at his lack of success, it suddenly came upon him that his future was not as a juggler. He really felt the call to the Lord. And within a week, he was enrolled in a Catholic seminary. 2 years, graduated with the highest honors, was ordained as a priest, and he was selected among a few others to go to Rome to meet the Pope. And as his turn came and he bent down and kissed the papal ring, the Pope said to him, my son, what were you before you heard the call to God? He said, a juggler. And the Pope said, juggler? What's that? And he said, I'll show you. There's this huge candelabra with these 6-foot candles. And he takes two of them out and he starts tossing them up in the air. And he takes a third. And he takes a fourth. He could never manage 4 oranges, let alone 4 6-foot candles. And pretty soon he got all these candles in the air at the same time. And as he's doing it, all of a sudden there's a sound of heavenly music that pervades the latter room. And he lets these candles fall down, one after the other, right into the candelabra. The dome of St. Peter's opens up, there's a ray of sunshine, heavenly music, and an angel comes sliding down a sunbeam right to the feet of the Pope and his juggler. And he turns to the juggler and says, "Don't call us, we'll call you." Well, this is, in a sense, what Saudi Arabia has been doing all of this time. But if you ask yourself, what are the alternatives of Saudi Arabia, they really don't have. Because the Saudis are today in the middle of the most distressed, turmoil-stricken Middle East, really since World War II. There's never been anything like that. And if you think about it for a minute, there's Saudi Arabia with the Saud dynasty trying to perpetuate itself. There's Kuwait, which is a royalist kingdom. There's Qatar. There's Bahrain. There's the United Arab Emirates. And there's Oman, which is not a member of OPEC, but is also a royal. Now, all of these very, very wealthy oil-producing countries, between them, have a population, together, of less than 13 million people. And sitting on top of them is Iran, that despises Saudi Arabia, only second to the United States. Iraq, that has made claims on Kuwait and once invaded Kuwait. Syria. The three of them together with a population of over 60 million people who desperately need oil revenues, the PLO that would like to upset the political balance in the Middle East because of revolutionary basically. Sitting down here is also Egypt, which if you remember under Nasser had its spears sharpened and its guns prepared. I had war with Saudi Arabia in Yemen at one time. So the Saudis know that the greatest threat to Saudi Arabia is from their neighbors around them, not from distant places. And they also appreciate there's no good trying to fight an oil battle with Iran. Iran cuts prices to try to produce 2 million barrels a day. What are the Saudis going to do? Cut prices to fight them back? If they did, they could destroy Iran. They'd win the battle and lose the war because they would be exhibited throughout the Middle East as a venal country that cares nothing for other people, other Mohammedan people, only for their own riches, which they spend on themselves, which they waste on the industrialization of Saudi Arabia, which is our point. And then they ship all of the money, surplus money, to the United States and to London. So the Saudis are more afraid of revolutionary fervor in the Middle East than anything else, which means they have already started to move over for the Iranians. They could have stopped the Iranians from producing 2 million barrels a day, but they have moved over. And they know that in the future, they're going to have to move over, if ever the war between Iran and Iraq is settled, they're going to have to move over for Iraq also. Well, think about it for a moment. If the Saudis have to move over with the lower demand for Middle East oil which is taking place, they can't produce 10 million barrels a day. They can't produce 9.5 million barrels a day. They can't produce 8.5 million barrels a day. Which means if they're constrained for the next 5 or 6 years to producing something in the range of 5.5 or 6.5 million barrels a day, do you think they'll want the lowest possible price? They're off that kill. The Saudis now have to protect the price because they can't get it in volume. They've got to concede the volume to the Irans and to the Iraqs and in due course to the Algerians and to the Libyans and so on. And when they do that, they're no longer producing 10 million barrels a day, which they were doing in 1979, 80, early 81. So I put it to you that apart from all of the economic pressures on world oil, that there is virtually no one left in the whole picture that has an interest in lower prices. Even the Iranians, who, you know, you can't count on what the Iranian government, I shouldn't speak of the Iranian government. I don't know what kind of Iranian government there is. But whoever calls the shots in Iran, you know, they may at any given time deliberately cut prices for reasons of turmoil. But in the end, the Saudis are not going to fight it out on the price front. And so as far as we can see looking ahead, the surpluses that are still with us are going to exert pressure downward for some time on world oil. I mean, it'll lead to chiseling and price cutting and long kinds of differentials, but the price is going to hold. And then if you put in, we've got very little time, so no on the one hand, no on the other hand. I give it to you as we see it, the best probability as we see it, that by this winter time, there's going to be a strengthening of prices for a lot of reasons. Come the spring, we think there's going to be the beginnings of economic recovery around the world. Nothing spectacular, nothing spectacular at all, but just enough so that the upturn in the United States, and it'll happen in Germany too, and a little bit in France and so on, and in Japan, enough of an upturn so it begins to put leverage on the world demand for energy and even more leverage on the world demand for oil. So without anything spectacular happening, the price of oil, which now hangs around $30 to $32 a barrel, is going to go up to meet the Saudi Arabian market around $34. Moving up in that direction, which means a little bit less price cutting, means a little bit more oil to spread around so that everybody remains, nobody is happy, but nobody is so unhappy that he upsets the apple cart. And by 1985, 1986, the OPEC demand, which has been as low as 15.5 million barrels a day, will be in the range of around 22 million barrels a day, which is unsatisfactory, but they can live with it. And if they can live with it, you can bet that whereas the Saudis from 1974 to 1981 were trying to hold the price down, we think we'll seize the first opportunity, if it's political upset for sure, but even if it's a shift in world oil balances, no shortages, absence of surplus, which is a different thing, no big overhang of surpluses, they'll start moving the dollar price up and start moving thereafter the real price of oil. Because if you look into the latter 1980s and the 1990s, even without political turmoil, you'll have just enough so increases in world energy requirements so that the contribution of oil, which will have to be made, not as big as it used to be, but the contribution of oil, whatever oil can contribute will have to come at higher real prices because it's getting harder and harder to find the reserves to replace the reserves that we're pulling down. So the picture on the oil side is quite the contrary, we think, for what the conventional reason is. You know, price weakens and OPEC falls apart, oil prices collapse. We think that you're going to have through 1983, dollar prices around where they are today, but the wheat price is moving up to the firmer. Between 1983 and 1985, 1986, the dollar price is going up, but the real price may be eroded a little bit by inflation, and after that, the real price going up. Now, I think this means an awful lot to the position of Alaska, because if you were confronted with the same competitive pressures for your oil in a world in which the prices are all moving downward, it could be very difficult. You're going to have pressures in California because of the incoming new discoveries of oil. You'll have pressures on the Gulf Coast because of Mexico wanting to work itself out of the hole that it worked itself into. But with all of that, your Alaskan oil is still the oil which is essential to U.S. energy balances. The idea that we worked ourselves down from 8 million barrels a day of oil imports to about 4 million barrels a day, a hell of a lot of that was due not just to conservation, but to the economic slowdown. You turn it around, and if you visualize the United States coming just gently out of the devastating recession that we've been in, and we're going to need more energy, and the more energy means more oil, and the more oil means basically import oil. And a couple of years from now, all of a sudden, you know, you may have surpluses in the state of California, but in the United States, we'll be importing not 4 million barrels a day, but 6 million barrels a day again. And we'll be worried about the extent to which we are exposed to the possible cutoff of oil, but more importantly, to the blackmail that comes if somebody threat. The threat to cut off is even worse than the cutoff. If the oil is cut off, we know exactly what we have to do about it. But when we're threatened, we don't quite know what to do about it, and that's the worst part of the whole thing. Well, that's the picture that we have, which means that your oil is still vital in the entire picture, and with all of the ups and downs of competitive pressures which happen from time to time, you are still in the position in which your oil will command a reasonable and respectable price, which I submit will be improving over the years in front of you. For example, today, with all of the pressures, the spot price of Prudhoe Bay oil in the U.S. Gulf Coast is above the contract price. And that doesn't talk about a tremendous downward pressure on the demand for Prudhoe Bay. Now, let me tie that together with the gas outlook, because that fits in with all of your concerns about what's going to happen to the Prudhoe Bay gas, what are the alternatives, what are the chances of doing something about it. If we look ahead, I can see the U.S. gas picture in sort of three different phases. The phase we're going through now is what I would call a bubble bath. Bubble bath in the sense that we have surplus, we have more productive capacity than there is demand for gas. But at the same time, there's some movement to the upward movement of gas prices, because for how long gas prices were constrained by gas price ceilings and so on. So you have this bubble bath phase when there is surplus productive capacity, but still some upward movement of gas prices. Now I'm going to take a jump. You go into the 1990s, and I don't know whether it's going to be 1989 or 1990 or 1991 or 1992. It's the phase that we call the best of all worlds. And it's the best of all worlds for the gas industry, because that's when world oil balances start getting tight, but not short, where the real price of oil is going up, and we can't get as much new oil coming in as we're using up all the time, and where alternative sources of energy become tremendously important. And that's when the opportunities for gas really begin to manifest themselves. That's the phase which I call the best of all worlds. In between, you've got in between is the phase which I call what price competition. By 1985, 1986, we may have worked off the surpluses. With any economic revival, the demand for gas goes up a little bit and so on. Furthermore, we're now using almost 50 billion cubic feet a day of gas, and almost all of it comes out of wells in the lower 48 states. Now, we're going to find more gas, but nobody really thinks seriously that we can find more gas in the lower 48 states at the rate that we're using it up, which means that there's going to be a decline rate in the productive capacity of the lower 48 states. Now, the normal decline rate in a petroleum reservoir, you might figure at the rate of, I don't know, 4%, 5%, sometimes 8% a year, forget about it. Let's assume it's a very modest decline rate, 1.5% a year, 2% a year. On 50 billion cubic feet a day of gas, over 3, 4, 5 years, that kind of decline rate starts building up to a need to find the supplemental gas supplies which replace what we're losing in the reservoirs in the lower 48 states. So we'll take it from where? From California, we'll take some from Mexico, Canada. But during this period, the huge discovered reserves of Canada, which are surplus to their own needs, will still be more than we'll want from them. And therefore, they will want to compete for greater penetration of the U.S. gas market than what we're prepared to ask them for in terms of what our need is. Now, how do you compete on gas? You've got to compete on the basis of price, and that's got to be the border price, which means the Canadians, which are now being criticized for having too high a gas price, $4.90 at the border, will start saying that we've got to get off this formula price, and we've got to go to flexible pricing. We've got to move to penetrate U.S. markets, oil markets, fend off some of the coal competition as best we can. That's the period of what price competition. And that's the period that's the hardest period for Alaska in terms of any gas assets. If you take the Alaska Natural Gas Transportation System, I'm convinced, I've said this some time ago, but I'm convinced now that it's dead for one more reason than it was before. It always had a problem with economics. That is, how could they compete in price at the border? And roll it in with old gas. There's not going to be enough old gas to roll it in if you start talking about the late 1980s. Financing is a problem. The biggest problem that confronts that pipeline now is it has no more political constituency left. At one time it had a political constituency that was fighting for it. Canada was fighting for it because they wanted the access to the Alaskan pipeline to bring down their own gas. Hell, they have so much surplus gas in Alberta that they know they're not going to bring down Beaufort or Arctic Island gas for a long period of time. When we came out of those horrible winters, the states along the northern tier were desperately anxious to get more gas. They were the ones that sponsored the pre-build. Pre-build those two legs out of Canada even before you finished the Alaska Natural Gas Transportation System. Hell, now there's so much gas available to them that they're complaining about the Canadian border price of $4.80, $4.90. So there's no constituency left, really, north or south of the border, that's going to fight a political battle to help out the Northwest energy operation. So I think what's left for you basically are the alternatives other than that. And if you ask about alternatives, well, you've got two studies going on simultaneously. I want to start trying to preempt in 10 minutes discussion what they're going to be telling you for some time to come. But if you look at the one which seems to be favored, that is to say the All Alaska Line and gas exports to Japan or Korea or what have you, let me just confront you with some of the realities of the case. Today, liquefied natural gas is moving into Japan at prices between $5.50 per MCF and short of $6. Now, if your gas were available today, if you had to sell it in Japan at $5.50 to $6 per MCF and cover the tanker costs back to Kenai and your pipeline costs back up to Prudhoe Bay, what the devil would be lost? What would be left of the value of the gas? Now, of course, there's escalation.
The wellhead value would be negative.
It's hard to say. If you don't build natural gas tankers, but you buy the surpluses from El Paso, out of the Algerian fiasco, you can probably buy them for a fraction of their original cost, and you may be able to lower the transportation for a while. But Dome Petroleum, which is trying to export Canadian gas to Japan, has just signed a tentative contract with the Japanese with a price below $6, which nets back to British Columbia. They have to worry about the transportation costs. They have to worry about the pipeline costs, but their pipeline costs are a fraction of what yours are. And on top of that, you've got natural gas stacked up in, but you know who supplies natural gas in Japan now? Brunei was a little bit out of Fukushima, of course. Brunei, the first major country. Indonesia, with now four contracts signed and two more coming. Abu Dhabi out of the Middle East, and fighting for the next shot at is Australia, Thailand, Malaysia. Now, where does Alaska fit into the pecking order on a thing like this? Can be done. If the cost of waiting, if the waiting is too long before you can see your future markets, or if the cost of waiting is too great, then you may find that the producing companies may take the initiative to try to set up an LNG export, because they are under more pressure than anybody else. They want the fastest possible cash flow on their operation. Whether Alaska is in that much of a hurry.